This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Well, we've got the mandatory mini camps starting all over the place. We talked about Stephon Gilmore not out there, Aaron Rodgers not there. You know, it's basically we're taking attendance everywhere. That's what we're doing. It's not so much about what's going on out there. We're not looking at it as this is a make or break moment. It's about who's there. We're taking attendance, and now we're talking about a big-time Seahawks rival in the NFC West, the Los Angeles Rams. And joining us once again, she covers the Rams for ESPN.com. She's with us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Lindsay Theria is with us. Lindsay, how are you?
Good. How are you guys today?
We're good. Great. We're good. How's attendance out there?
Well, you know, the Rams actually wrapped up mandatory minicamp last week, had terrific attendance. One notable name that was not there was Aaron Donald. Sean McVay indicated that he and Aaron Donald were in communication, and, you know, some guys get that excused absence as long as they're in good standing and good touch with Sean McVay.
Yeah, I got to believe Aaron Donald's pretty safe, and he doesn't really need to be there, right, Lindsay? I mean,
no, and he proved that right a few years that he held out of all of the offseason programs and minicamp or and training camp, I should say, and still came in one defensive player of the year a couple of years before that contract situation. So he's almost better when he doesn't come to all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't want him there.
We had a guy like that up here named Walter Jones that would hold out every camp, and then he showed up and he would be just fine. So, yeah, Aaron Donald falls in that category. But how about as far as some of the coaching? I think Brandon Staley was a huge loss. Don't probably worry so much about the offensive side of the ball just because it seems to be Sean McVay's offense, Lindsay. But as far as defense, what's the word down there? How they're adjusting? Are they going to run the same defense? What's the word on that?
Yeah, so they brought in Raheem Morris, and it's kind of interesting because Raheem is kind of accustomed to running more of a 4-3, but they're going to go with what Staley installed. They're going to keep that 3-4 defense, and, Raheem Morris will put kind of some of his own twists into it, and I'm sure they'll do some creative things with Aaron Donald. But right now, they're staying as is. A couple of the position assistant coaches are kind of catching Raheem up to speed, and so far the feedback from the players has been really terrific, just about the energy that Raheem Morris brings and how things are going so far.
Let me ask you about the comment that seemed to have taken off this weekend when you're already laughing. You know what I'm going to ask you. Sean McVay was asked about being in a better mood with Matt Stafford being there, and his quote is, "Damn right I am. This guy, he's a special guy." And then he later had to clarify he's not taking shots at Jared Goff. And Lindsay, I find myself in a weird position of defending Goff. Now, I don't think he's elite. I don't put him in the top 10. But the idea that he just can't function without McVay, even if McVay called every play in his headset until the headsets went off on every play, he still had to complete those passes. He still had to make those plays. And this team went to the Super Bowl with him. So I don't think he's nearly as bad as some portray him as being. What's the perception out there? Does it just feel like, oh, now we've got somebody who's competent, now we've got somebody who can actually win games when you got rid of a quarterback? And again, not making the case that he's better. I think Stafford is better, but he's not nearly as inept as people portray him as being.
Yeah, you know, it's taken on an interesting kind of life of its own, this entire story, because, look, I know Sean McVay wants to always kind of be the nice guy, and I don't think when he said that comment about how he's in such a better mood this offseason, he did not mean that against Jared Goff as much as he meant it for Matthew Stafford. But at the same time, like 1 + 1 = 2, you wouldn't have Matthew Stafford if you didn't get rid of Jared Goff. So obviously that's part of your mood change. Jared Goff is a competent quarterback. He just might not have been the guy that could kind of go absolutely next level with Sean McVay. I've talked to so many people this offseason about Sean McVay's offense, and it's really kind of as complicated as it gets as far as, you know, all the pre-snap motions and everything else. And the fact that you have Sean, who's a little bit of a micromanager up until the last second, really kind of in there doing things. Sometimes it's a little bit hard if you're not quite as quick as him. So that's not something that Jared Goff will never get there, but he wasn't going to get there with Sean McVay, who also doesn't have the absolute most patience of any coach out there sometimes. You know, so you bring in Matthew Stafford, and obviously he's very experienced, 12 years in, and right now those two seem to be on the same page. So I think L.A. fans, Rams fans are happy to see Jared Goff go, but it still remains to be seen whether or not, you know, this entire thing turns around with Matthew Stafford.
Do you know what was the perception of him amongst his teammates in that locker room? I'm just curious if you heard much off the record, guys thinking that he was, you know, oh man, we're in a much better position now, or looked at him as a bit of a problem, or he just, as you said, wasn't capable of taking that next step. What did the teammates have to say about him?
Yeah, I think everybody, I don't want to say everybody because I haven't spoken to all 50 some odd guys in there, but plus P Squad. But I think that generally speaking, guys liked Jared, but I think there was some differentiating opinions on whether or not he was the guy who could really get the job done. So, you know, I don't want to make any blanket statements about his perception in the locker room. I think generally speaking, like I said, he was well-liked as a person. I mean, he was, you know, he was Jared, kind of a goofball in his own sense. But as far as whether or not he could be the quarterback, you know, depending on who you ask, very different answers. You know, some guys are very grateful for Jared. They got contract extensions because of Jared and the kind of numbers they put up with him as their quarterback. Maybe you talk to some guys on the defense, maybe not as big of fans because they needed a little bit of more scoring support there this last season. So a little bit divided on whether or not he was going to be the quarterback who could really take them to the next level.
You know, Lindsay, I was watching, got my first glimpse of Gerald Everett out at practice, and boy, he looks really smooth. And how big of a loss was that for them, and what kind of player did you how did you perceive him? How important was he to that offense?
You know, I think Gerald Everett has all the talent in the world. I think a kind of a change of scenery is going to be really good for him. He just really seemed to be kind of stuck in that number two position here behind Tyler Higbee. He'd flash at times, and other times he would kind of completely disappear from the game plan altogether. He's a great pass catcher, so I think if the Seahawks can really kind of hone in on his strengths and get him to focus in early, I think it's going to be kind of the sky's the limit for him with Russell Wilson.
What are the areas of concern with this team in terms of positions? We've talked about, you know, we're analyzing the roster, looking at all the different position groups and going, we don't really have answers at this spot, or this, a lot of question marks in this spot, whether we're talking cornerbacks or D-line, what have you. Where are those questions sitting with the Rams?
Yeah, I definitely think there's some questions in the secondary. The Rams lost John Johnson, perfect safety. He moved on to the Cleveland Browns this offseason in free agency, so that's going to be a big loss. He's also their defensive signal caller, great communicator, a very calm presence out there, and really savvy player. I think there's some questions what's going to happen opposite of Leonard Floyd with their pass rush. You know, they lost the starter, Samson Ebukam, who didn't necessarily light it up, but was a smart player. No kind of clear-cut replacement there. And then at cornerback, they lost Troy Hill, who had done a phenomenal job this past season for them in the slot. So there's several holes on defense. That's not to say that guys, you know, haven't developed. I didn't even mention Michael Brockers. Seahawks fans are very familiar with the Michael Brockers, Aaron Donald tandem. So definite holes at starting positions. You know, the Rams have some young guys they've been developing, but I don't know that the talent, the raw talent, matches the kind of guys that they lost.
Yeah, I'm with you on Troy Hill, man. I thought he was always very underrated, and seems like a big loss. I want to ask you about Andrew Whitworth. There was just I just thought there was no way after he got that knee injury that he was going to be able to, you know, come back from that. I mean, he's an older guy. What is he, 38, 39?
39, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just kind of surprised by that. But also, you know, it just seemed like the offense, Lindsay, there's a couple of times where, you know, I was mentioned in some plays where they didn't really ask him to do that much. You know, they, if it's, you know, he's on the fake side of a play, it just seemed like there was lots of times where, you know, he was able to just kind of, I don't want to say take a play off, but he wasn't, you know, having to throw a vicious block or anything like that. And it seems to, I'm just hoping that that's going to kind of be the case for Dwayne Brown up here, who's also an older guy, but yeah, Andrew Whitworth, I mean, that was surprising. Tell us about the kind of player that he is. That's the longest question you'll be asked ever.
Yeah,
by
I
the
lost
way.
Track of what the question
well,
is.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, summer of 2019, I went out to Colorado where Andrew Whitworth and his family have an off-season home to do a story about him, because it was kind of one of those times when he was wondering, like, what's next for me? Is this, was that the last season? What's coming up ahead? And I remember writing in the story at the end, like, you know, Whitworth's contemplating almost, I was leaning more towards, like, the end might be here. And here we are two seasons later, and he's still very much playing. So it shows you what I know and what I think. but he just kind of never really slows down. I mean, he's a guy who really had no reason to be at the voluntary offseason program, and he was there with the guys, with the younger guys and everything. You know, sometimes not doing quite as much because he has his own regimen to take care of his body, and obviously it's working with how long he's played. But, you know, I think the Rams kind of seem like they're going to let him play until he decides he, you know, it can't play anymore. And, you know, they're kind of trusting Andrew to make the decision of, like, when he feels that he's not playing up to the standard that he wants to play. No one's tougher on themselves than Andrew Whitworth. So he's still going, and it's pretty remarkable and inspiring considering he's getting a little bit up there football-wise when it comes to age.
Yeah. Lindsay Theory from ESPN.com is our guest here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. She covers the Rams for ESPN. And Julio Jones was a story out here for a little while because, you know, the word was the Seahawks had made a call, inquired about him, and then we heard that he and Russell were talking about playing together. And so it became a conversation. Then we heard that every team in the NFC West made a call on Julio Jones, obviously, including the Rams. And I think Jalen Ramsey was very vocal about wanting him there. How serious did that get out there in the way of expectation, in the way of, hey, this could happen, it should happen? What was the discussion surrounding Julio and the Rams?
You know, I think it was a pretty serious discussion inside the building on what could we do to get him and what might that look like, who might that cost. You know, ultimately, the Rams, from what I understand, had to kind of pull out because they weren't willing to pay what they thought maybe the Falcons wanted from them. But it was a real consideration, which is also wild given it kind of seems like at every turning point the Rams are in the conversation for all these big name players, and you wonder at what point does the bank run dry, do they run out of future picks to trade, but they were right there in it. From my understanding, but that trade went down on a Sunday, you know, probably up until maybe the final kind of few days of that.
Hey, Lindsay, tell us a little bit about Matthew Stafford. I guess he's one of those guys, just it's very mysterious to me. You know, he's a really good player, okay? He's just not had a lot of success. Have you got a chance to talk to him? And I wonder if there's a huge amount of relief for him that he's somewhere and's got a fresh start.
Yeah, you know, he obviously requested a trade, wanted a fresh start. He got it here in L.A. With Sean McVay. And so I think, you know, when you're looking for kind of an offensive-minded coach and a quarterback with a fresh start, there's perhaps no better place to do that, and especially after kind of putting up with the Detroit winters for as long as Matthew did. You know, the number one thing that comes across me, he's just a very low-key guy. He kind of has just a calm demeanor about him through our couple of news conferences with him. Seems pretty calm on the field, which is interesting because Sean McVay's so fiery. But when you listen to Sean McVay talk about him, and when you kind of hear Sean McVay and the details he shares about Matthew Stafford and what makes him so excited, I mean, it's obviously Matthew Stafford is a very intelligent football player. The smallest nuances of the game he has down to a pack with the little things that can make a difference between, you know, going to the division playoffs and winning the division playoffs. So it comes down to, like, football savvy. They love his leadership. They obviously love his arm strength. I mean, the Rams went out and got a couple of speedy weapons to try and open up the field more this season. So everything is very – Sean McVay's in a very good mood with Matthew Stafford, and it seems that Stafford is equally happy to have kind of partnered with McVay.
Hey, last one before we let you go, Lindsay, on that same front. If to me, from the outside, I look at it and say, well, there's a unique pressure on Stafford now that didn't exist in Detroit because he always had the excuse of, look what he's doing with this terrible franchise. They give him nothing to work with, yet, you know, he's putting up these numbers, and he got to the playoffs three times despite what he had to work with. Now it's reversed. Now he's got everything at his disposal. Now we're really going to see what he's made of. And it, to me, brings a unique expectation and pressure that he hasn't had to face before. Is that sort of accurate in terms of the way he's being viewed out there, that he's the one to get us over the hump? He's the one that can achieve what Jared Goff couldn't?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know that pressure lays solely on the shoulders of Matthew Stafford. I think that pressure is really also on Sean McVay. I mean, Matthew Stafford is a quarterback he had to have. They had to get rid of Jared Goff. They had to trade not one but two first-round picks to go get him. So now you have Matthew Stafford. You have Aaron Donald. You have Jalen Ramsey. Those three players are just superstars, really. And now you have to get over that hump. So I don't know if the pressure is as much on Matthew Stafford as it is just on the Rams as a whole, and really coming down to the Rams decision makers on who builds that roster. Obviously, general manager's Les Snead. But from my understanding, there was a lot of push from Sean McVay to go get Matthew Stafford, whatever the cost, minus Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey. They're not letting go of those guys, but whatever else the cost was, go get that QB. So I think that's really where the pressure is.
Lindsay, we always appreciate it. Great stuff, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Lindsay.
There you go. Lindsay Theory from ESPN.com covers the Rams for ESPN, does a great job with that team. And I don't know, maybe Stafford doesn't feel that pressure. From the outside, I just look at it and say there's a lot of expectation being placed directly on him. Yeah, certainly McVay and everybody else has a hand in it, but he's viewed as the difference maker. We were doing the best we could with this guy. We propped him up as good as we could. You know, he's Goff, there are limitations. Now we've got a guy without limitations. Now he's in a situation where he's got the benefit of weapons, and he always had that really comfortable excuse in Detroit of being part of a really bad franchise that didn't surround him with anything.
Right.
And now the view is opposite. So I could see him going in with some level of, okay, I've got to live up to this now, because there isn't the excuse of, oh, he doesn't have weapons. He doesn't have the right head coach. He doesn't have the right pieces around him.
Yeah, he's been one of the more interesting quarterbacks to talk about over the years, just because, and when we talk to Clayton, it's like, okay, what's your impression of Matthew Stafford? You're always kind of like, he's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, but I thought it was interesting to hear her say, you know, about how complex the offense is that they're running. And, you know, and I always make the joke, hey, if Jared Goff can run it, but clearly at the end of the year, there was something about where Sean McVay is usually a very positive guy, and you could see him when they did the Hard Knocks down there, I think it was them and the Chargers.
Yeah.
He was giving him so much affirmation. It was almost like, you know, what you do to your kid when you're teaching him how to ride a bike without the, you know, the training wheels. It was like, oh, you're doing great. You're really doing, you know, there was a lot of that. So, I mean, I think it'll probably be a relief for Sean McVay to have somebody. And it sounds like I'm just constantly dogging Jared Goff.
That's because you are.
Well, yeah, it's not personal. But
it's just the sunsetting thing. It just never left you.
That always gets it. But I'll tell you what, the fact that he went out there and played with a thumb and, you know, he was all banged up.
The Seahawks. Ugh.
Yeah, I admire him. He made a play, the one where he dumped it off to Cam Akers, where he was running.
The one where he was wide open? And
no, he was running towards, he scrambled somehow, and then, you know, Akers was like maybe a yard in front of him, and he just kind of flipped it to him, and he took off running. And yeah, I mean, he made some plays, but I just think, you know, Stafford's going to be interesting to watch. And then the other thing is just how much of that offense comes here. You know, I was telling you guys earlier, I thought Jake and Stacey had a great debate about how much of this offense are we really going to see. Are we going to see, you know, and Jake thinks it's going to be 90%, you know, on Shane Waldron, 10% Pete Carroll. And he felt like, you know, before with Schottenheimer, it was like 60-40. You know, more 60% with Pete, and now it's going to entirely flip to be something. And I think that's what everybody, you know, was talking about in the offseason when they were saying, oh, Pete Carroll, he's too old, that they were afraid that he's going to meddle with the offense, because there was also that thing about, hey, we got to stop turning the ball over,
right?
Because, you know, Russ was throwing interceptions. So, but Jake, you know, seemed to think that it was going to be, and Stacey asked a great question, like, why would he give up that much control when he never has, you know, over the last 10 years?
I think that's a fair question. I wonder if there is an element of, I'm going to trust you until you give me a reason not to.
Yeah.
When it comes to a new coordinator. Hey, we put you in charge of the offense. This is your baby. Obviously, we're going to weigh in, and you're not completely autonomous, but
right,
this is your baby until things go the wrong direction. Then that's when I feel the need to jump in. You know, that maybe that's part of the sell to get him to come here. This is, you shape this offense the way you see it. Yes, I want the run to be a heavy part of it. However you fit that in is how you fit it in. And I just feel like it could, with a new guy coming in, I feel like it could be that Pete's ready to jump in if he feels it's necessary. But I would lean toward Jake in that
debate that you're bringing up there.
I hope that that's right. But again, yeah, Stacey posed a question that was very legitimate. Hadn't really, you know, thought about it from that standpoint as far as percentage, how much we're going to see. You know, I just hope we see, because what we're talking about here, and Lindsay just told us, it's a complicated offense. There's lots of pre-snap motion. That kind of flies in the face with up-tempo, though, by the way. You know, up-tempo, you know, getting up to the line, going, yeah. I know, you know,
that's
you
my
like
thing.
Mixing it in.
That's my thing. Tempo.
Well, and I think it's good with Russ, but if you're going to do all the pre-shifting, pre-snap stuff, that, you know, that doesn't allow you to go up-tempo. So it'll be interesting to see how they, you know, kind of sprinkle that in there. But I just think Russ is as ready as anybody to be, you know, to run that kind of offense. He is very good, and I think he's maybe one of the smartest quarterbacks in the league right now.
All right, coming up, we heard Lindsay say they've already wrapped up their mandatory minicamp. The Seahawks mandatory starts tomorrow, right? Tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah, so theirs starts tomorrow. So should we be worried about Jamal Adams in minicamp, and is he going to be there? If he is he just hanging out? We'll get into the Jamal Adams conversation coming up with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Coming up at the top of the hour, the professor, John Clayton, will join us on the program. Stay tuned for that conversation. We'll get into everything NFL with him. And certainly we will talk to him about what's going on with Jamal Adams. Now, Brady Henderson was on... Well, who was he on with? Do we know? I don't know who he was on with. All right. He was on with somebody.
Some other show that doesn't matter.
That's just exactly kidding. Right. This is the top of the media mountaintop right here. but he was talking about Jamal Adams and said that Adams and his reps and the Seahawks have entered into negotiations as of a week ago.
So from what I understand, I checked on this a week or so ago, and I was told that they have had the Seahawks and Jamal Adams' agent, Kevin Connor, have had some initial negotiations. As of when I checked on this a week or so ago, there had not been a ton of progress made, but there is still optimism in the organization that they're going to get a deal done.
All right. I can live with that. It's headed the right way. They're talking. Optimism. I like those words.
Yeah.
As far as it pertains to minicamp, which starts tomorrow, goes Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, what do you think? If you're Jamal, what I would love to see, and I don't expect him to be out there running around if he's working on a new deal, that's typically not protocol. I would hope that he would be there. He'd be one of those guys that we've seen many, many times in the past, guys dealing with contract situations, not just Seahawks, any other team. They're there, see him wearing a jersey, but they're standing on the sidelines. They're talking to players. They're just not going through drills. They're not doing any of that stuff. But they're there. I think that says something like, listen, I'm not going to risk anything. I got too much on the line, but I want to be here for my team. I want to hear. I want to learn. I want to be present, but I'm just not partaking, so to speak.
Yeah, we don't really know how he's going to react in this situation. I mean, he did force, you know, do a good job of forcing his way out of the New York, away from the Jets. So, you know, maybe he's going to be a hardball, you know, player here. We'll see.
He said he'd run through a wall for Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
He loves Pete.
Yeah, well, and he loves this team. And so that, I guess for that reason, you know, it makes me think, you know, anything that you hear from him in the press is just part of the negotiations. You know, it's not like, you know, he's not going to say, oh, yeah, I'm sure we'll be able to work something out. You know, we're both reasonable. It's like, no, you're going to rattle the cage.
His agent's going to go, shut up.
Yeah, like mine used to me.
Yeah.
And I would say,
stop.
I would play for free.
Stop speaking.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I would say don't get, you know, thrown by that. I don't think it's going to mean anything. It's just what happens. That's what you do. That's part of the negotiating process. But
any fear that this drags on, or that they're going to reach an impasse, or they're not going to be able to get it done?
A little bit, just because he's very competitive. And also, you know, if he wants to make the case of being the highest paid defensive player, I would say one thing, though. I mean, and this is where it gets ugly, and this is why you have an agent. You don't want to, you know, go in there and they're going to start telling you what all of your shortcomings are.
Yeah.
You know,
which is their job to do, in explaining why we're not going to give into the number you're presenting.
Exactly. So, and you know, one of the first things I would say is, why didn't you catch that pass that Sam Darnold threw right to you? I mean, it was right in his breadbasket.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to make that play. You have to.
Did he have any of his injuries at the time? Because I would think if I'm his agent, I'd be going, well, he was gutting it out, and he had a torn ligament in his thumb, which required surgery. He had a dislocated shoulder, which required surgery. I think they're going to counter with, well, look, he was gutting it out by even being out there.
And he was. And I would argue on his behalf in that respect, too. I wish he wouldn't have, shown all the injuries and all the stuff.
Maybe
that
was negotiation. Maybe that was planting the seed for, hey, look at what this guy, look at what he dealt with.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, Bob. I think absolutely you're right that was part of it. And you love that about him. I know it sold me just because, we didn't hear about it during the season at all. And a lot of guys will do that. Like you'll hear at the end of the year, oh, yeah, I was, dealing with this, that, and the other. And he still went out there and played. And then, remember when he hurt his shoulder in the last game of the year against San Francisco? He was over on the sidelines. I was like, uh-oh. But really what it was is that he was really down because he knew he wasn't going to be able to play 100%. And he wasn't. And there was a couple of times that we saw in that game, in the playoff game, where if his shoulder hadn't been, injured, he would have had, I know he would have been able to knock a pass down, but he couldn't because his arm was basically attached to his side.
And a tackle he couldn't make.
Tackle down in the goal line. Yeah. So, I mean, there was that's absolutely part of it. And if you're the Seahawks, you love that. You love the guys that battle through injuries and don't complain about it. So I just think he's too good of a football player. He's too eager to play. And the Seahawks, I've mentioned this before, but I think when they didn't have the right safeties in there, that's when their defense really suffered.
Yep.
And now that you have two really good safeties and a guy who can just make plays all over the place, they will find a way to make this happen. I'm not expecting some big, ugly, drag out with your new team. I mean, look, he kind of reserved all of those feelings for the Jets.
Yeah.
And now the Seahawks are his new savior as far as a team goes. I just don't see it getting ugly.
You have to believe, at least I do, I believe that John Schneider and Pete Carroll had a ballpark idea of what he was going to require when time to talk. They didn't go into this blind and say, wouldn't it be fun to have Jamal Adams? Let's just trade our draft capital and then we'll deal with things later. Who knows what he wants, but bring him in now.
right.
So there's a lot that goes into a deal like that outside of assessing his value and, okay, is he worth two firsts and everything else we're giving up for him? How old is he? Injury status, all that. What's it going to take to re-sign him? Because we know he's coming up on the final year of his rookie deal. And is he a malcontent? You got to consider every part of this kid.
Sure.
So the idea that they're going to go into this and be blindsided by what it is he may be asking for, I don't find realistic. I think they have a ballpark idea. Well, you think he's going to ask, and maybe they adjusted as the year went on, and by the end of the year they go, wow, he had 9.5 sacks. Okay. His asking price, I could see him asking for X. I don't know what that number is. 18 a year. I'm just throwing that out there. But I think they have a ballpark idea of what it's going to take to bring him back into the fold, and I don't imagine they're surprised by anything. May not be what they want to pay. Maybe it'll be a little higher than what they expect, and that's the game. They ask high, you offer low, and you meet in the middle. That's how negotiations go.
Right.
So, what's he ultimately going to settle for? I think will be probably in the neighborhood that they're pretty clear on, within, $1 million or so, I would say. I would be stunned if he just said, I want $23 million a year, something where they're just going, wait a minute, what? I don't think they're going to be stunned by his asking price. I don't think they're agree to it and they're going to negotiate it down because that's the game. But I think they had an idea before he ever signed to come out here, before that deal was ever signed, I should say, for the trade, they had an idea of what was in store.
Absolutely. And that's something that Pete will reveal every once in a while. I remember it was a few years ago and they were talking about Richard Sherman. And he was like, yeah, and we had planned for this.
Yeah.
And you hear all the time. So, yeah, absolutely. They're not just going to – I mean, how – it's something we didn't think about. Like, I think we did talk a little bit about, well, is it going to be hard to resign? We know his contract's coming up and everything. But they're, like, down to, the dollars and cents of how close we're going to be to in order to get this guy. So, I don't think anything's going to be shocking. They know the kind of player he is. And then, he goes and gets the 9.5 sacks. I mean, I think he does deserve to be paid a little bit more, certainly more than what safeties make.
Yeah, he's an impact player. He's finding ways to make impact, right. an impact in a game where often safeties are sort of anonymous. If they're not a lot of action on their side of the field, or maybe they come up with a tackle here or there, you know, they're not always in the mix. Whereas this guy's having, you know, drive-changing plays on a regular basis.
Right.
So, and 360 saying, you're giving too much credit to Pete Carroll and John Schneider. I don't think we are.
Yeah, I mean, they've run a team that's gone to the playoffs, what, 9 out of the last 11 years? And, yeah they've
I think they know
looked into the future, yeah.
All right, coming up, is J.P. Crawford presenting an interesting question for this Mariner team? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
We got the professor, John Clayton, joining us at the top of the hour, so stay tuned for that. You guys can text in questions for John, 710-710 to the Mac and Jack's text line. That'll be coming up in less than 15 minutes. But switching back to the Mariners for the moment, one of the bright spots over the weekend and this season for the most part has been the reemergence of the offense of J.P. Crawford that he was touted for coming out as a prospect. And I always bring this up because I think it's such a cool story that his...
It amazes me every time you bring it up.
But the knock on him was we don't know if he can play defense at the big league level. His defense is a problem. The offense was not the concern. It was his defense. And fast forward, you get him with Perry Hill. He's one of the best defenders, not just shortstops. DJ's got a note here. He's defensively one of the best in all of baseball. Leads Major League Baseball in defensive runs saved with 8. And that's not just shortstops. That's the entire league. That's all positions.
And the good news is these stats are not from Pro Football Focus.
These are actual facts. These aren't opinions based on, I think, his zone rating is this, and he should be able to get to a ball here or there. That's for another conversation, but he's currently hitting .274 with a .342 on base percentage. I mean, he's not a guy that you expect to hit a home run. You expect him to get on base and then be a problem, which is what he does. And what's interesting is he's doing this at a time where you've got an offseason coming up where you've got premier names all playing shortstop that are going to be free agents. You got Carlos Correa. You've got Javi Baez. You've got Corey Seager. You got Trevor Story. You got all these names that people are looking at going, oh, man, the Mariners, they've got to have one of these guys. Now, could they sign one of these guys and maybe they move JP to second base? Maybe. Maybe there's something like that. We've seen it done with much more established players like Alex Rodriguez, who was a Gold Glove shortstop, moved to third base when he signed with the Yankees, even though he was a better shortstop than Derek Jeter was at the time. But they made it work. So maybe something like that. If they feel like, hey, we really want the offense and the defense of one of these guys, so we're going to make a commitment to, you know, throw out Corey Seager, just throwing that out there. All right, so then maybe JP becomes your second baseman.
Mm-hmm.
That's a possibility. Or is he eliminating the need to spend that money on a position player, at least in the infield or at shortstop, and say maybe they can spend that money on somebody for the rotation? Because you got a lot of depth in your outfield. A lot of your up-and-coming stars, hopefully stars, are all outfielders. You've got some infielders, Noelvi Marte, that are going to be coming up. Maybe a third baseman is where you'd be looking, because I don't think they currently have one in the system that you're looking at as a star in the making. That's a high-level prospect at third base. So
still worried about Evan White at first.
Yeah, I don't know with his injuries, and I don't know if he's just hit a run of bad luck. His are the injuries we've talked about Mitch Haniger not having. The tight quad, he's got a pulled quad, and this has been a problem before. And so I'm not completely sold on White. I'm completely sold on his ability to play just otherworldly defense at the major league level. He is a phenomenal first baseman. Can he hit at this level? Can he be available? Can he stay healthy? Those are all questions that still have not been answered. But I just think it's interesting. JP is kind of put at the team, and we'll see with, you know, a lot of time left in the season. But if he maintains this, say he's somewhere in this neighborhood hitting .275, .280, maybe by the end of the season, still playing great defense, I wonder if that alters their plan or if one of these guys could have been in their plans.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, in the month of June, now it's really fun to cherry pick stats.
Yeah,
you know, you go back to a certain, but I just took June. He's hitting .383 right now, his average, and on base percentage is .456. But the thing that I think is important is that he's hitting the ball hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something that we Well, Divish said it. You know, maybe he had one hit during spring that was hit hard. Or
he said he hit three or four balls, not even hits, just squared them up, whether he hit them at somebody hard the entire spring.
Right. And then, you know, the other thing that Mike Blowers always talks about is that he's spraying the ball all over. You know, he's hit to left field pretty well and consistently. So, yeah, it's really looking good for him. It's just interesting, you know, you mentioned, you know, he was touted for his offense and not his defense, when defensively, man, he's got a great arm. At one point, the Mariners lead the league in double plays.
Still do. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's just been awesome. Plus, he's super cool.
You like the
JP,
way he looks?
I have not seen a cooler dude since Robinson Cano.
Does he have swag?
He's definitely got that.
He's got some swag.
I don't want to ruin that word by uttering it, Bob, because when it comes out of my mouth, it doesn't sound cool. But JP is fun to watch. I mean, he just also, when he takes like a throw down, you know, like if it's a throw from the plate on stealing, just the way he just calmly kneels down right next to Segi, he just makes it look so choreographed. It's like he knows what's happened, you know, what's going to happen going forward. That's the part that I just enjoy. So it's, you know, above his throwing arm, his, you know, ability to field, his hitting, it's just how smooth he is and how confident he is.
There's a certainty to the way he plays. And that's what Cano
had. That's a good
Cano just was like, I got it. I got this ball, and he was smooth, man. Mm-hmm. I know everybody's got their feelings about Cano, but you got the best of that deal because you got the best out of him in terms of leadership and what he produced, and then before he completely fell apart, you were able to pull off a magnificent trade for him.
Yeah.
But when he was here, he was fun to watch because there was just a certainty to the way he played defense. It was just very calm. There was you never saw him fumble the ball or really look rigid or, oh, man, I got to hurry. You never had that feeling from him, and you don't get that from JP, as much ground as he covers. He's got great range out there. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe somebody who's big into analytics is going to tell me, he's average or this or that. No. I'm going with the eye test, and I'm going with what those around him say. And he's a phenomenal defensive player. My biggest question would be, can he maintain his offense? Because his defense has been consistent pretty much since the time he's gotten here and really started getting in with Perry Hill, and you saw a change, and he's been that guy ever since. Doesn't mean he doesn't ever make an error, but he's getting to balls other guys don't get to. He's incredibly accurate with his throws. He's got good steam on him. He's an all-around, really, really good defensive player. Can he maintain his offense would be the only question. And somebody's saying, when we were talking about, do you bring in one of those other guys, said, double up. A good shortstop can play any position in the infield. All right.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, Seager was not originally a third baseman. He is a very, very good defensive third baseman. That wasn't his position coming in here.
Really?
No.
I did not know that.
No.
What was he playing then?
I think he was at the minor league.
He was a stud shortstop in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ackley was your second baseman, but, you know, then you had Brendan Ryan was here when those guys came up. So, they made moves. And we talked about, again, A-Rod going to the Yankees, Gold Glove shortstop, who was considered by just about everybody a decidedly better defensive shortstop than Jeter, but it was Jeter's team, so he started playing third. So, yeah, whether JP switches or they happen to sign one of these other guys. Now, if they're going to invest in one of these other guys, I'm going to guess part of the negotiation for them is going to be, hey, if they want to play shortstop, I'm playing shortstop. If I sign with you guys, I'm not signing to play second base. So JP would be the one that would have to move.
Yeah.
Is how I see that.
But you just love – it's kind of encouraging that hopefully, you know, we'll see this out of Evan White, because you could say the same thing about defensively.
Oh, how
fantastic he is.
Yeah.
But it's been a bit of a struggle.
Yeah, hopefully that gets rectified. I'm pulling for him. All right, coming up, we've got the professor talking football. If you guys have questions, text in your questions right now, 710-710 to the Mac and Jack's text line. John Clayton joins us next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.